You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning. A special invitation to all those that are out in the foyer. If they'd like to come in and join us this morning, that would be wonderful. We'd love to see you. And they can't hear me. Hello. Welcome. As we do every Sunday, we humbly acknowledge that we are on the traditional territories of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, whose lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. So welcome this morning. It's Mother's Day, and a very special welcome to all moms and all ladies that are here this morning. And I have one special mom that I really wanted to recognize this morning, and that is Mother Earth. I wanted to recognize her and say happy Mother's Day. Isn't that funny? Happy Mother's Day to our planet, from all of us, that call her home. And thank you for all you provide us with, and sorry for those that don't treat you with respect. So welcome this morning.
Grounded, Guided, Growing, A Time for Centering, from Scott Kearns.
There we go. This holiday, this commemorated day for mothers, is joyous for many. And in my work just this week, I have walked into the lives of two people, one where mother wasn't there and things were very bad, and one where mother was there and things were very bad. And I see this over and over and over again. And I had one of those lovely mothers, and I celebrate that every single day. But I have watched people that have had a very bad start relative to this celebration today, and done remarkable things to thrive. One of them, alcoholic father, narcissistic mother, no model at all, and yet Little House on the Prairie was her model of what family could look like. And she hung on to that and has actually duplicated it in her own life. But that takes courage and strength, but it takes someone, even if it's a television figure, to model what love looks like. So I've put some pictures together of the start that everyone has, and I'm going to be really blunt here. I don't for one minute think that there's a plan or some great big idea of where a child gets put in this life. It is just the luck of the draw, and so I stand here who I am because I ended up being parented by those two particular people, but I'm no different and no better than anyone who didn't. So there's my little speech there. Could you back up one? So we're starting with the blank of snow, and I'm just going to play us through the nurturing that a crocus received during the springtime. typifying that whoever in your life has nurtured you and warmed you and shown you love, that's who we celebrate today. If that's male, if that's female, if that's relative or not. So that's, and then we'll work into our sharing song. So there is something to celebrate on this day, and that's the nurturing love of someone who cared.
We have three readings this morning. Elie Wiesel was a novelist, political activist, and Holocaust survivor. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for speaking out against violence, repression, and racism. The Norwegian Nobel Committee called him a messenger to mankind. And he wrote, "The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. The opposite of art is not ugliness, it's indifference. The opposite of faith is not heresy, it's indifference. The opposite of life is not death, it's indifference." Richard Dawkins is an English ethologist. I had to look that up. An ethologist is, ethology is the scientific and objective study of animal behavior, viewing behavior as an evolutionary adaptive trait. Anyway, he's an ethologist, evolutionary biologist, and author, I'm sure some of you have heard of him, whose work has significantly influenced the growth in the public profession of atheism. And he wrote, "The total amount of suffering per year in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. During the minute that it takes to compose this sentence, thousands of animals are being eaten alive. Many others are running for their lives, whimpering with fear. Others are slowly being devoured from the inside by rasping parasites. Thousands of all kinds are dying of starvation, thirst, and disease. It must be so. If there is ever a time of plenty, this very fact will automatically lead to an increase in the population until the natural state of starvation and misery is restored. In a universe of electrons, selfish genes, blind physical forces, and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." And our last reading comes from Walter Miller Jr. He was an American science fiction writer who only published one novel, A Canticle for Leibowitz. A Canticle was set in a monastery in the desert following the devastation of a nuclear war, and the book spans thousands of years during which time the monks of the monastery preserve scientific knowledge until such time as humans might be advanced enough to handle it. He wrote, "Ignorance is king. Many would not profit by his abdication. Many enrich themselves by means of his dark monarchy. They are his court, and in his name they defraud and govern, enrich themselves, and perpetuate their power. Even literacy they fear. For the written word is another channel of communication that might cause their enemies to become united. Their weapons are keen-honed, and they use them with skill. They will press the battle upon the world when their interests are threatened, and the violence which follows will last until the structure of society, as it now exists, is leveled to rubble, and a new society emerges. I am sorry, but that is how I see it. Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
The focus moment is printed and still sitting in my home along with my sermon and my sermon notes. So I'm using the phone, and it'll be fine in this. It might be a little more tricky in the perspective, so. I liked it better when you were lovely. When the sunshine on your face made the whole world glow. I liked it better when you read poems about ancient kings and queens, their strength and their power. I liked it better when you showed me stars, naming the constellations that lit the dark night. I liked it better when you were quiet, your head heavy against me, in such peaceful bliss. I liked it better when you were singing, when music filled both our hearts with joy and rapture. I liked it better when you were baking, your hands laying the warm dough in darkened tin pans. I liked it better when you were happy, when the smile upon your face could warm entire rooms. I liked us better when we didn't know the future of the whole world lies in our own hands. I don't think I'm going to be able to read that anyway. So clearly, we're headed in a direction. Sometimes that's clear on a Sunday morning when the readings are read and we know where we're going and we end up at that place before we leave. And we've got that little bit of something tucked into us. We can pull it out in the middle of the week and think about it again. We can talk about it on the way home, or we can say, oh, I'm not going there again, and we just hide it away. But this week, like so many weeks, there was stuff happening in the world that was so hard that it was hard to just not bring it into this place. It made it almost impossible to look at the readings for this Sunday next year in the lectionary that talked about what the world was like back then when we believed everything that the Bible said and it made it easy. And I don't often, those of you who are visitors, I don't usually talk about the Bible and I don't usually challenge beliefs around deities, but this week I needed to go there and that's where I'm going today. I begin with Elie Wiesel's work, his life, the book Night, which he published, which was his most powerful work, recognizing what happened to him and what happened to so many people in the concentration camps through which he was moved during the Second World War. And trying to sew into that horrible existence some kind of beauty, some kind of peace, some kind of hope and sustenance that would get them through that. And at the end of that time, there were big questions about who that God was that was supposed to keep us out of places like that. There are big questions through the 20th century when we found out how cruel we could be to one another on a global scale. Not that we weren't horrific before, we were really bad before, but we started to understand it and to question some of the things that we had held inviolable, that we couldn't let go of, that we thought were perfect truths that could hold our lives together. And they fell apart bit by bit for individuals, for whole peoples over the course of the 20th century. But here we are in the 21st century, and we're still 20 years into it. We're still recognizing that by clinging to old beliefs, we think we can make the world a better place. By not changing things, by just staying the course, by letting people's belief systems be people's belief systems, everything will still work out okay. For some unreasonable reason, things will all be okay. So this week, when a woman who annually puts together a Holocaust memorial event in her town in Arkansas, when she and those who were gathering with her, as they did every year, got together and began to walk through the main streets of their town, alongside them were neo-Nazis who were yelling things like 6 million more. And here we are in the 21st century, in 2019, and that goes on. And did you see it on the news? Was it on the CBC? Did it make it to Fox News? No. Did it make it to CNN? I don't think so. It just happened. And it's the kind of things that happen. And, you know, we have to accept that that kind of stuff is here in the world. But Eli Weissel wouldn't have accepted that. He wouldn't have agreed. He would have said, you know, you did this to me and my people all that long time ago, and yet you're indifferent to what's going on today. You're indifferent to the horrors that are being bred in people's hearts. No matter the source, whether it's a sense of fear, of having no rights, or rights slipping away, or whatever it is, it's there and it's germinating, and we're letting it happen. And we wouldn't be able to look him in the face and say, yeah, we're letting it happen. There's sort of a lot of right-wing thinking and there's left-wing thinking, and we vacillate between the two of them on different issues sometimes, where we think, yes, it needs to be this way here, and no, we need to give it a little more space over here. And we could probably look back through our political history here in Canada, and we could watch things shifting toward, you know, the more self-interested, and then shifting more toward the selfless, more communally interested. And we could watch that jagged dance down through the course of Canadian history. We could watch it happen in our neighbor to the south of us. We could watch it happen in any country in the world. Yemen was not that long ago a place of industry and power, a place where democracy flourished and women could bathe in bikinis on the beaches. But that has shifted now. It's gone. It's moved away. And we watch that happen through the course of human history over and over again as we move from one extreme to the other, or try to find some middle way that will appeal to both. Chris Hedges wrote a book several years ago called The End of Liberalism. I can't remember what it's called. But he was saying, you know, that liberal place that tempered the craziness of the left and the histrionics of the right, that found a way to bring them together in something that benefited most of the population, that liberalism is dead. That we've gutted a hole in the middle of our opinions, and we've left them lying on the right and the left, arguing with one another, but not finding common ground that might feed all our souls. So, we turn to the Richard Dawkins reading, which tells us the truth about who we are. Because we are animals, just like the rest of nature. Cultured, of course. We wear clothes a little better we look better in them than most animals do, I must say. Sorry, Jack. Jack looks great in his little coat. Jack is our friend who visits us regularly. But the world that Richard Dawkins describes as a scientist is a world that is terrifying. It's the world that Scott can bear to watch on those BBC Life shows, which I, as I've said before, have to sort of keep away from because they're too tragic. I remember watching, there's whales that are beached right now that are being tended and cared for, but they're not out of danger. The mother and the cub are not out of danger. Is it cub? Calf, thank you. Didn't think that sounded right. Calf are not out of danger, but on one of those BBC Life shows, you know, the mother whale had stayed in this place, this nursery where her calf could grow strong and where she shed so much weight to feed that calf. And then they had to find their way to the feeding grounds. And on their way there, the killer whales showed up. And they attacked and they attacked and they attacked until that calf was dead. And the mother, after all that time and energy, had to make her way alone to the feeding grounds. Nature is an ugly thing. And as Richard Dawkins says, you know, the thing that happens if there's suddenly plenty, and the red fish are back in the St. Lawrence River, so I'm watching, reading that going, I wonder how Richard Dawkins would think about that, where the stocks of fish rise and become plentiful. And what happens when they get that plentiful? Well, then they start having to starve some of their parties out. They've got to starve off this area or this area because we've got to get it back to some kind of equilibrium. And that equilibrium means, like, killing off some of our own. That's the way it happens in the natural world. I don't think that we have ever fought wars to manage our population, or we have ever let epidemics just go crazy without any kind of attempt to address it as a way to manage our population. And I don't think that we've just let famines unfold as a way to... Or maybe we have. Maybe we've been doing that all along. I mean, when most of us think about, you know, what life is like, we think about this. We don't think about walking miles every day to get water. We don't think about the fact that our kids drink water out of, a pool that's right next to open sewage. We don't think about the effects of walking barefoot. And what that does when the things that get into your feet get into your system. We don't think about that stuff because that's not what's going on here. Yet there, the millions of people who die as a result of those simple things is massive. And we really haven't got a lot of it in our minds most of the time. So maybe it's not a strategy, but maybe it is a blindness that we need to think about, a blindness that we need to address, a blindness that only when it's cured can we find a way forward that allows us some dignity as humanity, not as North Americans, but as humanity. And what does that dignity look like? I loved the last reading and the book. Normally he wrote mostly short stories, but this book that he wrote, I loved the idea of the survivors being these monks that hid away all the scientific knowledge for thousands of years, because though it had been developed, and I wasn't really clear whether or not, I haven't read the book, I wasn't clear whether or not it was that they just, those who survived, didn't know how to use the knowledge. It didn't make sense to them. They had to develop their mathematics all over again, and then their understanding of the natural world, and then their understanding of how they could alter the world. Maybe they had to do all that before they could hold that scientific knowledge. But I thought, wouldn't it be good if some of our scientific knowledge just disappeared for a few generations until we could get the moral fiber to actually deal with it properly, instead of unleashing things on the world that we aren't quite sure we've got a handle on. That can be used in very negative ways. Are we mature enough to handle all of the scientific knowledge that we have? All our ability to mutate genetics and to shift and change the food that we eat to alter it? Yes, I know it's only through altered foods. Genetically modified foods that we'll be able to feed everyone. But when particular companies own the rights to all that food? Is everyone really going to be fed? So have we actually evolved morally to the point where we can use that technology in ways that are helpful to us? His reading was about ignorance, not indifference. Though I think ignorance protects us from having to feel our indifference. If we remain ignorant of things, if we don't actually know what's going on, then we can't possibly be blamed for the problem. If we don't know the combination to the safe, then we can't be blamed for the gun having been taken out and sold to the police, right, when it was really ours. If we don't know the combination to the safe and we don't have the knowledge to change genetic structures, then we can't possibly be responsible for that. If we don't know the names of the companies that are taking over all of the clean water resources in the world bit by bit, then there's nothing we have to say to them. We're just enjoying the water that comes out of our tap, clean, for now. There are so many things we can be ignorant of. And I think if we each shared maybe six things, each of us, the circles of overlap would be, there would be some places where we overlap, where we named the same things. But in this room, we could probably come up with all kinds of things that we know about that someone else doesn't. I don't mean list the things you're ignorant of. You can't do that. I mean list the things that you think other people might not know about. And then find out whether they actually did. You know, the fence at the school, who else knew about that? How many of us didn't? Way more. We were ignorant of that fence and that sign and what those children are doing. And that's an amazing thing that they're doing, and we need to know these. So what happens if we remain in our ignorance? I mean, if it's a fence and some garbage on it and a sign from the children, that's okay. But what if it is the health of the oceans? What if it is the air that we breathe? What if it is the First Nations people of this land who don't have access to clean water on a regular basis? And I was delighted when Ruth shared at the board meeting, and we decided that as a congregation we want to start using coffee here that comes from an Indigenous entrepreneur who is purchasing coffee in Central and South America from Indigenous communities, roasting it here in Nova Scotia and selling it. And for every 50 bags he sells, he puts a water purifier in a home in an Indigenous community. And so we're going to be part of that because someone knew that. The rest of us were ignorant of that project, but someone knew about it. And so now it can be ours and we can do something about it. We rely so heavily on the stories of other people to help us understand our world. And if we don't open ourselves to those stories, we don't hear them. And we rely on our news outlets for those stories that are beyond our doors that we can hear about. And Ruth heard about that on Steve Paikin's agenda. We find out about things that are going on. But in our lives, holy moly, I can hardly keep track of my news feed on my email, for heaven's sake. And right now, I've stopped the whole pile of them because I can't bear the weight of it. Hour after hour after hour as another email comes in and tells me what's going on in the world. So I take us back to Eli Weissel and his reading. That the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. Indifference is what will ruin us in the end, not necessarily ignorance, because I'm counting on other people knowing what's going on. I don't have to carry the entire weight of the world on my shoulders, though I'm sure we like one another better if we pretend we don't. I'm sure we like one another better if we don't go up and ask those hard questions. And so we end up in these polite conversations because that's how we like one another better. We don't push what it is we believe because that's how we like one another better. We don't force someone to sit down and watch a video. I read a blog that a mother who was a vegan and her daughter had a friend over who wanted something to eat, candies, particular candies. So the mom showed them a video of how those candies were made, which had both of them sobbing uncontrollably at the end of it and vowing not to ever eat those candies again. But if I was the other kid's mom, I don't know that I'd be that happy that that took place in my home, in someone's home, when my child was over there. We don't want to have those conversations. And so we add to the level of ignorance in the world, and we suggest that we're indifferent about what's going on. And I don't have answers to how we deal with that, because I think those are huge problems that as a community we can try to work out, but individually we've got to take it. We've got to take those conversations into our hearts and figure out how we can be real and how we can honor what's going on in the world. I labeled the theme for this week, Who Cares? Because the lectionary passages for a year from now on this Sunday feature the shepherd image in the 23rd Psalm and in the in Jesus' story about the being the shepherd, and everyone has to get through the gate, and he's the gate that will get them through there and care for them. And so I was thinking about caring and who cares, like who does the caring? Many of us, most of us, I hope, were raised in families where moms cared for us. They were the caregivers in the home, predominantly. Some of you may have been raised with fathers doing the predominant caregiving, but I think that's the next generation that saw that more than we did. So the caregiver was the mom. The caregiver was the one who thought about meals 4 days hence and made sure that they had what was in the house in order to make it, or in other parts of the world, thought about what was needed the next day and walked to get it from wherever they had to get it, who sheltered their children and lamented when some of them died because they couldn't care for them all. Mothers cared. They were the big carers. But in our lives, in the West, over the course of the last 2,000 years and longer, five actually, we've had a big caregiver who has been the God in the sky. And around the world, people have been wrapped in different iterations of that through our history, since the axial age in which cultures around the world began to create the religions of empathy and compassion. And those gods have guided us and cared for us. But as the world bends towards secularism here in the West, as more and more people, not that they lose belief, but they lose a sense of security that that belief might once have provided, how that care falls from the sky, falls from the God onto our shoulders, is a challenge that we all have to bear. Trying to find our way forward in a complex world with so much stuff going on that we can barely keep our heads together or keep them from exploding. How do we manage that care? I think this is one of those ways, and I think this is one of those places. And I know that I've been kind of hammering you hard the last few weeks, but really it's because we're here together that is the most important thing. Not what I talk about, not the readings, definitely some of the music, wholly the community sharing time, and then the engagement that takes place out there and that takes place out here. And sorry, I had to whistle to get you in here today, but out there in the lobby and here in the coffee hour, in those getting togethers during the week, and I'm always delighted when I hear that two people in the congregation went someplace together and I didn't even know they knew each other. It's those connections that take place that create the resilience in our lives that allows us to step out and say one thing in a place that we know it's going to be a little uncomfortable, but we're going to say that one thing. And it's not going to have swearing in it, and it's not going to have finger pointing, but it's going to be the one thing about which we are not indifferent anymore. And because we are not indifferent, we cannot protect everyone else's ignorance. And so we say that one thing. I wouldn't advocate the video thing, but we say that one thing to someone that we know and love, to someone that we trust, to someone that we've known for years, or with whom we've sat so many meals or walked so many places together, and we say that one thing that we are no longer indifferent about. And in so doing, we create that opportunity for change, for healing in our own hearts, for challenge in the hearts of others, and for hope. Because we aren't the natural world that Richard Dawkins knows so well. We are humanity, and we are held together only by the bonds of love that are strengthened between us. And if we love one another, and as John says, we love our grandchildren and the children they will have, and the children they will have, that we will move past that indifference into engagement, and through engagement move another past ignorance and indifference to engagement, and the world can change. We have told these stories since the beginning of time, and we must still tell them. Thank you. That most of you know what that S in the brackets means at the end of perspectives. It's that I share with you my perspective because I'm not indifferent about something. And the S is how you add yours. You take what happens in this place and you take it out there and you share it. And this slide is one of our most important ones too. That we watch each other away. We have each other's backs. We will connect and care for one another because that's what we do. So go out into the world, a world made challenging through our own actions and our own activities upon it. And be peace, be challenge, be honest, be loving, and be the change that is so desperately needed in this world right now. Go from this place in peace.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.